Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juneau LIL, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Kopp, Representative Millett, who is alternate for Representative Reinbold, Representative Stutz, my Vice Chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 330, DNR, Disclosure of Confidential Information, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. I'd note that Representative Ledoux has also joined us. This is the third hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. To provide a brief recap of the last meeting on Wednesday, the committee heard from the Department of Revenue and a member of the oil and gas industry. During that meeting, there was also discussion of a potential amendment, which apparently had been drafted initially by the administration. And my office distributed that amendment to the committee yesterday, and members will find that in hard copy before us. We asked if anyone was interested in offering that amendment, and Representative Ledoux responded with interest. Representative Ledoux has also advised that she's interested in offering an additional amendment to House Bill 330. So if anyone would like to offer an amendment to this bill separate from the one we're going to take up today, let my office know and please submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Sunday. It is my intention to take up amendments to House Bill 330 on Monday that we don't address today. So we're going to move forward with the one amendment before us. I will note that to the extent we make amendments, the legislative legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill. The amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we'll proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. And finally, the maker will have a one-minute wrap-up. When we come to an amendment, the maker can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the back, and since we only have one amendment today, that's not difficult. Representative Ledoux.
Before I move the amendment.
Yes.
Did you say that any other amendments are due today?
Sunday? At 5. So we can take them up on Monday.
Okay. All right. I move amendment number 1.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Ledoux, tell us about amendment number 1.
I'm going to let my trusty staffer, Greg Smith.
And I note after Mr. Smith has finished, Ed King from the Department of Natural Resources will also be, I will ask him to come up and comment on the amendment. Go ahead, Greg.
Very good. Thank you. For the record, Greg Smith, staff to Representative Ledoux. Amendment number 1, the general intent is seeking to limit these type of disclosures subject to the protective orders to oil and gas, lease audits, appeals, requests for consideration, as opposed to any other type of, to all types of leases. And also, I believe a clarification is that the department can probably talk to more is adding this net profit share after royalties. I believe that better encapsulates what's needed and types of the different types of work for these disclosures.
And I'd recognize that Representative Eastman has also joined us. Anything further? Representative Christ Tompkins has a question, then we'll bring up Mr. King.
Thank you. Given the addition of relating to oil and gas, is it your expectation, or have you had communication that this will satisfy Usabelli Coal Mine's concern?
We have reached out to Usabelli. We have not gotten a confirmation that this does, but we hope and believe it does.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Christ Tompkins, follow-up.
Would it be possible, if you do hear from the company, to share that with the committee?
Yes, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions for staff. Mr. King, if you could come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources.
And Mr. King, I'd just ask you generally to give you the department's position as to this amendment, and then we'll see if there's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are there are three changes that happened with this amendment. The first one just limiting the happening on page 3, line 25, adding the words relating to oil and gas. This amendment would, in our mind, restrict or narrow the scope of the protective orders to issues only relating to oil and gas, therefore alleviating the concerns, the hypothetical concerns that Usabelli or others may have in the mining community. Generally speaking, Mr. Chairman, we don't object to this narrowing of scope. We don't know of any issues where outside of oil and gas we would actually use this protective order right now. Obviously, we'd prefer the more general authority in case those kinds of situations arose in the future. We would have the authority to deal with them. But because we don't know of any of those issues existing today, we don't oppose the restriction of this that this amendment would impose. Mr. Chairman, the next two amendments are technical changes that the department felt were would benefit the bill. On page 3, line 27 or 26, the word lease in front of the word audit is not necessary, and as a modifier, it can be interpreted to modify the words appeal or request for reconsideration as well. So we suggested just removing the word lease was a cleaner way to approach this issue, and then just making the grammatical change on the article from A to N. And Mr. Chairman, the third portion of this amendment that occurs on page 6, line 20, adding after the word royalty the words or net profit share. This has to do with the fact that net profit share lease terms are not considered royalty payments, and so when we, as the department, do run into a situation where we have to audit the net profit share payments and make sure that they were properly, that revenue was properly paid and collected, we just want to make sure that the terminology is there. In there's no doubt that the intent of the legislature was to include those net profit share terms.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. King? You get a pass. Any discussion as to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, is the objection maintained?
I withdraw my objection.
Is there any further objection to amendment number one? Hearing and seeing none, then amendment number one is approved without objection. And that's the only amendment we have today. We are potentially going to get one more amendment, but we will take that up on Monday. Our second and final order of business today is House Bill 259, Confining Vehicle Loads, sponsored by Representative Stutes. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Matt Greening, staff to Representative Stutes. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and then you may begin your presentation. And as the practice in this committee, we will take up questions after he's finished his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Stutes. Before you today, you have House Bill 259. Whether somebody overflows the bed of their truck with rocks and gravel or plywood, scrap metal, loose debris on the way to the dump, or simply fails to tie down large objects in a flatbed, unsecured loads are an indisputed hazard to other users of the roadway and pedestrians. Improperly secured loads can cause serious injuries, property damage, and fatalities. The AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety concluded that from 2011 to 2014, road debris was a factor in more than 200,000 police-reported crashes. Those crashes resulted in approximately 39,000 injuries, 500 deaths, and additionally, the report found that about two-thirds of these accidents were the result of items falling from a vehicle due to unsecured loads and improper maintenance. In another study by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, it was found that there were approximately 440 fatalities caused by roadway debris in 2010. The data was gathered by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. All 50 states have laws that currently require drivers to properly secure loads in any vehicle or trailer and impose fees that range from $10 to $5,000. In most states, failing to properly secure a load is a traffic violation. In Alaska, even if it results in a serious physical injury, it is an infraction punishable by a fine not to exceed $300. However, 15 states have instituted possible criminal penalties for failing to properly secure loads. I would also note that there's a legislative research report in members' packets that compares those laws in states that have passed similar laws and provides additional information about Maria's law, which this legislation is closely mirrored after. Last year, the state of Alaska, via a proclamation by the governor, the mayor of Anchorage, the Anchorage Assembly, the mayor of the Matsu Borough and the Matsu Borough Assembly, officially declared June 6 as Secure Your Load Day by issuing proclamations and resolutions recognizing the hazards of failing to take the simple steps of severely affixing every load. These documents are also included in members' packets. HB 259 increases Alaska's standards for load securements of all types of materials and requires covering or maintaining 6 inches of freeboard with loads consisting of sand, dirt, rock, gravel, or similar materials. It also raises a violation to the level of a Class A misdemeanor on the first offense if it results in the serious physical injury of another person and with criminal negligence, or causes $1,000 or more in property damage. The legislation will decrease roadway litter, property damage, injuries, and fatalities on Alaska's highways. It is a responsible measure to protect the safety of Alaskan drivers, to avoid costly repairs that result from the actions or inactions of others. And as invited testimony today, I have Robin Abel and Kelly Roy online for testimony. Robin is not only a nationwide expert and advocate regarding load securement, but she's also the mother of Maria Federici, who's the namesake of Maria's Law in Washington State. Robin's 24-year-old daughter was struck by a piece of particle board that escaped from the back of a trailer in front of her. She was nearly decapitated as the debris crushed every bone in her face, leaving her blind. Miraculously, she survived. At the time, there was no law addressing the consequences of unsecured loads, and the driver was cited for a traffic infraction and fined. Robin has dedicated her life to changing the law, educating the public, and doing whatever she can to avoid this from happening to others. Thanks to Robin's efforts, Washington legislators adopted what has been called Maria's Law, which criminalizes a person's failure to properly secure a load that results in injury or death. She has been leading education and law-changing efforts across the country, but I will let her tell the rest of her story later. Also for invited testimony, we have an Alaskan, Kelly Roy, who's actually a constituent of Rep. LaDuz, who has experienced a very similar tragedy to Maria and is also very fortunate to be alive, but I will let her tell her story personally to the committee. In the previous committee, Kelly flew all the way down from Anchorage to tell her story, but she was unable to do so today due to work, and she's online. Kelly was actually the impetus and driving force behind this bill. Her life has been forever changed, and again, in Alaska, there was no recourse besides a traffic fine. She has been leading the effort in Alaska to raise awareness and educate the public, and I am truly grateful that she brought this bill to us and also that she had the courage to step forward and tell her story. These types of tragedies are completely avoidable with a few simple steps of taking time to inspect your load and secure it properly. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll go through the sectional.
Please. And I know we'll come back to it and move the committee substitute, but we're looking at the committee substitute, which is what's in front of you. Go ahead.
Thank you. So on version L, page 1, or section 1 on page 1, line 3 through page 3, line 4, AS 2835-251 is repealed and reenacted. Subsection A1 and A2 on page 1, lines 4 through line 9. This subsection states that a person is guilty of a crime of failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree if, with criminal negligence, they violate B of this section, and as a result causes serious physical injury to another person or property damage of $1,000 or more. Criminal negligence itself applies to the act of securing the load specifically. Subsection B1A, I, and 2I on Big B, and Big B on page 1, lines 10 through page 2, line 6. This subsection specifies that a person commits the offense of a failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree if a person drives or moves a motor vehicle loaded with any material on a highway unless it is secured or situated in a way that prevents it from escaping the vehicle or shifting to the extent that the vehicle's maneuverability or stability is adversely affected, or that the load is treated by methods approved through regulation by the Department of Public Safety that are designed to settle the load or remove loose materials before being driven on a highway. Moving on, subsection B2 on page 2, lines 7 through 10. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that a person may drive or move a motor vehicle loaded with sand, gravel, dirt, rock, or similar materials without the securement requirements listed in B1A, 2I, and B, if at least 6 inches of freeboard is maintained around the perimeter of the load or a cover is used and securely fastened. And I would note that the current confined load statute does require that you already tarp or confined loads consisting of dirt, rock, or gravel. So the 6-inch freeboard exemption is actually something that's not currently in law right now, but adds them another option besides covering their load. And moving on, subsection C1 on page 2, lines 11 through 14. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this Act do not apply to a vehicle that deposits sands, liquids, or other materials for the purpose of cleaning or maintaining or improving traction on the highway. And that was in recognition of maintenance vehicles, DOT vehicles, and that is actually already in current statute as well. Moving on to subsection C2 on page 2, lines 15 through 16. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this Act do not apply to the natural accumulation of snow, ice, mud, dirt, or similar materials. We wanted to exclude that, so you know, if you get in your truck and you drive off and you have a little bit of snow in the back of your pickup or some residual mud, this wouldn't be applying to you. Subsection C3 on page 2, line 17. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this Act do not apply to a vehicle that is removing snow or hauling snow after removal. And this is in recognition of municipal vehicles, DOT vehicles, that are essentially loading dump trucks with snow to clear the roadway. And that was in recognition that you're creating a large safety hazard by requiring them to maintain that 6 inches of freeboard. It would slow down the removal of snow. Subsection D on page 2, lines 18 through 20, this subsection specifies that in prosecution under A, which is, again, in the first degree, when it's with criminal negligence and somebody is either injured or there's $1,000 of property damage, a person being previously convicted of a violation of this section is a prima facie evidence that a person acted with criminal negligence when securing the load. So it allows the court. It basically creates a rebuttable presumption that prior history of this violation is evidence that you did act with criminal negligence if you injured another person seriously or you caused $1,000 in property damage. Moving on to subsection E1 on page 2, lines 21 through 23, this subsection specifies that failure to secure a load in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Subsection E2A, B, and D on page 2, line 24 through page 3, line 2. This subsection specifies that failure to secure a load in the second degree is an infraction, punishable by a fine of not more than $300 on the first offense, $750 on the second offense, $1,500 on the third offense, and $2,500 on the fourth offense. The penalty for the first violation is consistent with current statute for confining loads. And subsection F on page 3, lines 3 through 4, this subsection specifies that criminal negligence in this section has the meaning given in AS 1181-900, and I have that definition if anybody is curious about what that is. Section 2 on page 3, lines 5 through 6, AS 2835-253 is amended by adding a new subsection. This is strictly a conforming amendment to reflect the repeal and reenactment of 2835-251 in Section 1 of the bill and the repeal of 2835-255. AS 2835-255 currently houses the penalties for both AS 2835-251 and 2835-253. Basically, when we repealed the section, we removed an infraction for a completely unrelated or the penalty for an infraction for a completely unrelated offense. And just for reference, 253 is it requires that you have mud flaps for anti-spray, so it won't be hazards to other users on the roadway. So there's no substantive change here. It's strictly a conforming amendment. And then Section 3 on page 3, line 7, repeals 2835255, which is the statute I just referenced that houses the penalties for both of those statutes or both of those violations. And I do.
And so before we get to questions about from the presenter, we have a committee substitute before us. Representative Christ Tompkins, can I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
I move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute for HB 259 version 30-LS0917/L as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, the committee adopts the committee substitute as we move forward. And I will note that we do have two people that are invited testimony. We may have others testifying, but now is the time for questions, and let's try to keep those for about 15 minutes so we can get to public testimony. Representative Ledoux.
I don't know. Can somebody tell me what it is?
Yes.
Representative Kopp, I'll let you answer the question.
That is how much height the sideboards of your vessel or bed of your truck have before water comes in or your load goes out. So if you have 6 inches of freeboard in a boat, it means you're only 6 inches above the water line before sinking. If you have 6 inches of freeboard in the bed of your pickup, that means if the load is 6 inches higher, it's spilling out.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
And it's not, it's a follow-up to either Representative Stutz or to Mr. Greening. So I guess I'm thinking on page 2, line 7 to 10, that, I mean, I follow it for sand and dirt, but gravel and rock, I mean, it would seem like gravel or particularly rock, you know, could get above that 6 inches of freeboard, and that this might be a loophole that kind of subsumes the entire bill.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the 6-inch freeboard exemption was actually taken right out of Washington state law, and it was a negotiation with, when Maria's law passed in Washington state, it was a negotiation between the bill sponsor and the trucking association there. And it's been in practice for 10 years now, and I haven't heard of any specific issues to that regard with the trucking association or the bill sponsor, the people I've been in communication with in Washington state. I can certainly see how there could be an instance when that happened, but I'm just not aware of any issues with that exemption and how it's been applied and safety hazards that it's had in Washington state. But I believe Robin Abel, who is one of the invited testifiers, could speak a little better to that because she's very active in following up on that law and how effective it's been. She's been working with DOT, the Washington DOT, quite a bit. But I believe she would probably be better suited to address how effective that's been as far as protecting the safety of roadway users.
Follow up?
I mean, if it's so safe for big rocks, why wouldn't you have the freeboard exception for everything? I mean, a rock can be really big.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe, you know, if it was the will of the committee, it's something we could do to address that if it was a concern.
Thank you.
And I see Representative Stutz may have a response as well.
Well, it seems to me that the rocks are below the 6 inches. And so I think part of that might be due to, you know, being picked up by going fast down the freeway. A rock isn't going to be picked up and blown out. Whereas if you have 6-inch freeboard and you've got, like, particle board or something like that, it, even though you have that 6-inch freeboard, you still have the potential of just the wind or whatever you want to call it when you're driving down the road of picking up a corner of it and blowing it out.
And Representative Kopp has a follow-up response as well.
So the way I'm reading the bill, since we're on the freeboard subject, it looks to me like it's not preventing a load being loaded in the traditional way, which is mounded. It's just that as it comes down and runs into the wall of the bed, it better have at least 6 inches, so that as things roll around, there's a 6-inch wall there to catch it, because it would be almost impossible to load a belly dump or a dump truck flat. And I think we all understand there's going to be a mound there that sticks above that 6 inches, but and that's why it says is maintained around the entire perimeter, not the entire bed is below a 6-inch line. That's a whole different thing.
Can I add something to that briefly, Mr. Chairman?
Sure, go ahead.
When I spoke to the drafter, and we did take the idea for this out of Washington state law, but we were very specific that it be crafted in a way that did allow the mound to be loaded in. So when DOT and commercial vehicles are loading those types of materials, they're allowed to have the cone in the middle. And that was a very specific intent of ours when we drafted those words. So you're definitely correct on that, Representative.
Representative Christ-Tompkins. And Representative Ledoux, I wasn't sure if you were done with questions, but I'll come back to you. Representative Christ-Tompkins.
I guess just a comment. My understanding is similar to Representative Copps on the perimeter freeboard piece, at least as I read it. But my question primarily relates to other states that have passed this. Do you know to what extent criminal charges have been brought under this new law in those states, in Washington State, for instance?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, I can't give you specific information. I do know that enforcement of this typically happens when there is an accident, and that's typically when it happens, is when there's a serious accident, when there's the police get involved. That's when the enforcement of this usually occurs. To the extent of how often it's enforced specifically, I can't speak to that.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
I would... And your response would be similar to what I expect, although I would be interested to know, to get a sense of, with what frequency this law being on the book sort of leads to accidents being handled differently and at a higher level, and a level presumably commensurate to their severity. So I just wanted to flag that. My other question is just as a refresher, what is the sort of sentencing associated with a first degree, or rather a Class A misdemeanor?
Through the chair, there's a fine, and then there's a imposition of jail time. So the sentencing for jail time, a defendant convicted of a Class A misdemeanor, I'm sorry, this is 1255. And through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, I apologize for that. AS 1255-35, a defendant convicted of a Class A misdemeanor may be sentenced to a definite term of imprisonment of not more than a year. And again, that's not more, and it's typically not imposed to that maximum. And as far as the fines go, I'm looking at AS 1255-035, and that's B5. Up to $10,000 for a Class A misdemeanor, but again, that is very rarely, from my initial research, imposed to that maximum amount.
Thank you.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I want to clarify, when you were originally speaking of the bill, didn't you say that currently there is in statute a statute that requires rocks and sand to be covered?
It either needs to be confined or contained so it doesn't escape, or a cover is used.
And that's in current statute.
Right now.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. And this doesn't supersede that or preclude that.
It doesn't. It does have through the chair. Sorry, Representative Stutes. It does have the 6-inch freeboard exemption, which I believe is what Representative Ledoux is getting at. From my initial conversations with the Washington DOT and mostly Robin Abel, who's been very active on this, that 6-inch freeboard exemption seems to be effective in keeping things from escaping the vehicle. But I'm certainly not an expert on that issue.
Representative Ledoux.
Right, going back to the freeboard, I've learned a new term today. So, it doesn't look like, and is there another statute here that I need to be looking at in conjunction with this? Because this has the or. So if you look at page 2, lines 7 to 10, the 6 inches of freeboard is maintained around the entire perimeter of the sand, gravel, dirt, rock, or similar material, or the load is covered and securely fashioned. Shouldn't it be and the load is securely covered and securely fastened? Because, I mean, if you've got this big heap of rock, and we agree that the freeboard doesn't have to come up, you know, 2 or 3 feet. But wouldn't, because there's this mound here, kind of like the pyramid or something, wouldn't you have to make sure that you've got both the freeboard and there's something around the rock or the sand or the gravel? And this says or rather than and.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I definitely can follow your logic there. I could see how you could have and be tied to B1A and I and 2I on page 1 and 2, so that it would be, I think what the way I understand your question is, so you would either have the freeboard or a tarp, but that would need to be tied to it not escaping the vehicle, so that you would need to be, it would have to be confined and have 6 inches of freeboard, or be confined and have the tarp. And right now, I think that if it is viewed as a loophole, I think that and probably could be helpful there.
Well, and just in terms of, I know Representative Ledoux, you may not spend as much time pondering dump trucks as some of us do. And I can tell you that when you drive around Anchorage, you often see gravel trucks and trucks transporting rock for construction purposes that are uncovered, meaning that the bed of the trailer is uncovered and there's a mound of rock or sand or gravel or whatever. And you'll also see covered loads where they actually have a tarp that goes over the back of it. But if you used and, you would actually take away the option for the truckers, which is, I think, a fairly common practice. And I think Representative Kopp, who's next in the queue, might say I'm correct about that, but that you'd take away the current practice that they do have the option of not covering those loads up when they're traveling. And I think if you changed or to and on line 8, you would have that impact.
All right. So let me dialogue with you as
sure, absolutely.
Okay, so you got this truck and it's got this little bit of freeboard around it, and then you got this big pile of gravel, and the thing stops really quickly. Doesn't all the gravel or the rocks or whatever, you know, you're on an icy road, just come out of the thing and start going every which way? And if it goes every which way, then isn't that what this bill is supposed to make sure it doesn't?
I'm going to let Representative Cobb have a shot at that.
Sure. So it's been a while since I've enforced the commercial motor vehicle section, but there actually is a limit on the height above the bed in the commercial motor vehicle, and I think it's 12 or 18 inches, even in the middle of a big belly dump. And it's nearly impossible for weight that heavy to shift to, like, come flying out, I mean, unless the truck went from 0 to 30 in about 2 seconds, because not only is, so the reason why there's a mound is because naturally when a loader is loading it in, it's emptying out a huge shovel and it just piles up. But they're not allowed to, like, have it be up 36 inches above the bed. It's generally, from a driver's perspective behind them in a car, you can't even see most of the time that it's actually a small mound there, because they are limited to how high they can stack it. This freeboard requirement definitely would be more restrictive. And to what Representative Klayman said, loads are not uniform. Sometimes they're hauling material from they're demobbing a job site, or they are they're taking apart a building, and it's very odd. So that is where you definitely want to leave the second occurrence of the word or in line 8, because they can tightly secure that, but the freeboard doesn't work at all because of odd pieces and shapes, angle iron sticking out, and they just need to have it tied down and secure, but the freeboard would really prevent them. I mean, having the dual requirement would prevent them from being able to do a lot of things.
So, so these trucks that you're talking about is commercial trucks. You know, what about the guy who's just, you know, moving? I mean, he buys some rocks, and he's not a commercial person, but he's buying rocks and he's putting them in the back of his pickup truck. He can put them, I think, under this as high as he wants to.
He better have it secured properly.
And well, I thought the securing is the freeboard.
Well, then he can't stack it as high as he wants to if you have a freeboard requirement. I mean, in a small pickup, it would be pretty tough.
and the small pickups would be more impacted by weight restrictions.
The dialogue.
Small pickups are going to get more restricted by the practical reality of how much weight you can put in the back of the small pickup. They'll run out. They'll basically break the pickup before they hit the freeboard requirement.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, whatever Representative Ledoux, I have an entirely different question about that section.
Representative Ledoux, do you have questions, or do you want? And I think some of the questions may, because we heard this bill in transportation. Some of the questions you have about circumstance will get brought to light by the public testimony that we're going to get to fairly quickly, I hope. Representative Kopp.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking back on page 1 of the bill, there are two ways to get a misdemeanor, one being that you violate Section B, which is you don't have a properly secured load to prevent it from leaking, spilling, or it shifts your vehicle in a way that adversely affects it. And on top of that, then you cause serious physical injury to another person, or line 2, the second option there on line 8, page 1, is you damage property of another person in an amount of $1,000 or more. So a couple things. In the law right now, a misdemeanor damage value at an accident scene is $2,000 or more. In other words, if you have $2,000 or more in property damage, if you don't report it, you are in misdemeanor territory. So if you even have two people and you both get out and you agree, okay, we're just going to take care of this, if there's $2,000 or more, it's still a mandatory report. The other thing is that...
So Representative Cobb, does that suggest, are you saying that in the world of consistency, we should consider
taking that
to $2,000?
That's just a thought. It would be consistent in the law where the misdemeanor penalty kicks in now for damage, property damage, which I think is what we're talking about here, damaging property of another person. The other item is that looking at what a Class A misdemeanor is, too, it's even on your second DUI, that's a Class A misdemeanor. If it's your third one in 7 years, it's a felony. Most DV assaults, even fairly serious ones, are A misdemeanors because, they just are. It's sometimes it's hard to get to serious physical injury. Endangering vulnerable adults is a Class A misdemeanor. A Class A misdemeanor is very serious, and so I would just offer that maybe we ought to think about if we are going to do a misdemeanor penalty, maybe a Class B misdemeanor, maybe more appropriate or not, just for discussion.
Okay.
Because there is quite a range of behavior that fall under a Class A, and you can get up to a year in prison and a $10,000 fine. So, thank you.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do we have a drafter or someone on the legal side available?
We do. Hillary Martin is available.
All right. Then I have a question for Ms. Martin.
Ms. Martin, can you hear us?
This is Hillary Martin. Yeah, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman. And actually,
Ms. Martin, through the chair, so this bill on page 2 is going to reference last statute 1255, which is sentencing for a Class A misdemeanor. And I know we've recently passed some legislation which may impact that. We don't have any supplementals available to us yet. Can you please, for the record, remind the committee what the current sentencing is for a Class A misdemeanor?
Yeah, Representative Eastman, through the chair. A Class A misdemeanor is...
Oh, please go ahead and state your name again for identification purposes.
Sorry, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. And the sentencing for a Class A misdemeanor, as Mr. Greening reported, is in 1255-135. It was amended in Senate Bill 91 in 2016. So it would actually be 30 days under the statute. In Senate Bill 91, it was changed so that only certain Class A misdemeanors carry a penalty of a year. So it would be imprisonment of up to 30 days. And then the fine under 1255-035, I believe it's up to $25,000 for a Class A misdemeanor, which was also amended in Senate Bill 91.
Thank you very much. No, not for her.
Okay. So at this point, we're going to open public testimony on this. I would note that we also have some folks available, including Ms. Martin, for questions, but we're going to open up public testimony. And the first person we'll call during public testimony is Robin Abel, who's calling from Seattle. Ms. Abel, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Thank you. You can proceed. And I know because you've been very involved in this process, typically I limit public testimony to 2 minutes. I'm going to give you 3, and there may be follow-up questions that don't count towards your 3 minutes, but go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Well, Matt pretty much explained a lot of...
Oh, and be sure to stay...
My name is Robin Abel. I'm a mother in Seattle, Washington, who frankly had never heard the 6-inch rule before this happened either, so I'm there with you. But I'm here today to tell you a story because this is all about behavior and change. My daughter was driving home 14 years ago this morning, and so if I'm a little emotional, you'll know why. It was like it was yesterday that the hospital called me and said, your daughter's alive, please come back to the hospital. I donated an organ the night before because I got a call out of the blue, and it said, is your daughter Maria Federici? And, you know, it was the only time I ever wanted to say no, but I said yes. And when I got to the hospital, they said they couldn't save her life. I spent the next few hours filling out paperwork, donating her organs, but 14 years ago this morning, they called me and said, come back. She's fighting for her life. The board went through my daughter's windshield, weighed 40 pounds. It destroyed her eye sockets, her nose, her cheekbones, her palate. She had no face. It almost completely decapitated her. It left her blind. She has great hearing. She can dance. All the things they said she could never do, she is blind and she has severe brain damage. Her life will never be the same because someone made a choice to not spend a few moments or a few dollars time to secure their load to their vehicle. I have since changed 2 laws in Washington State mainly because they told me that what happened to my daughter was no more than a littering ticket, an offense. It was too late for my child, but it wasn't too late to save other lives, and that's why I do this. Because I know that if I can get a moment of compassion with you, and I'm a little bit partial to Judiciary Committee because you guys were the first committee I ever spoke before, but I had a mentor with me, was safe. So I've changed the law in Washington State. I'm the one who made sure we got the General Accountability Report in Washington, D.C., and recently Obama signed off in 2012 saying that there was money available. This was a serious problem, and he encourages the states to step forward and apply for funding through NHTSA. I've since moved on and had Secure Your Load Day, which your governor did agree to, and it's been a wonderful way to educate the public. Because as you guys know, as legislators, and especially in the Judiciary Committee, changing the law is only one thing. The hard work starts when you have to stand behind it and stand up and educate the public. Because we don't all sit down every year and say, well, let's look at our legislator did, okay? And we can't do that. So I ask you today to please look at this law seriously, consider it, You've got an amazing elasticist who's going to testify after me. People approach me all the time and ask me to help them, but I can count on two hands the people that actually made it and came forward, but I can only raise one finger to a person who has gotten this far, and it's a young woman in your state who has hurt herself, and she asked for help. I hope today you will acknowledge that she's an amazing Alaskan citizen. Because I'm partial to you, I hope you'll be favorable to this bill. I know it saves lives. The six-inch rule has not been a problem in our state. It allows when a truck takes the corner, the load doesn't go out unless they're already exceeding the speed. So it's been very effective, and it was a way we got the truckers to agree to support this law. They absolutely did not find it in any way, knowing that it was either they comply with the six-inch law or they cover. Now, the six-inch law does not apply to any other road, okay? It's only dirt, sand, and gravel and rocks. So please take a look at this law. Give it your consideration. We're doing it for your families. It's too late for our families. And please save some lives back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have questions for Ms. Abel? No questions. Thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate your sharing your experience, and we're glad that your daughter survived what was obviously a horrific accident, and we appreciate the reasons that you're engaged in this process. Next, we've got Kelly Roy calling in from, I believe, in Palmer. Ms. Roy, can you hear us?
Yes.
And Ms. Roy, can you make sure that you're on a handset and not a speakerphone?
I am on a handset.
Okay, perfect. Go ahead and tell us your name and where you're calling from, and go ahead.
Okay, my name is Kelly Roy, and I am calling from Anchorage, Alaska. And I want to say thank you, first of all, for listening to me today. But around 3 years ago, I was driving on the Glen Highway, and there was a driver on the road, a truck that was carrying an unsecured load. And that truck's unsecured load came apart, sending debris and trash and a large trash can that came straight at my windshield. Witnesses said my car rolled 4 times and that the Anchorage Fire Department had to cut me out of my vehicle because I was trapped. I was driven to the hospital with broken bones, bruises, cuts, but what nearly killed me was a massive blow to my skull. I had brain bleeding both on the outside and inside of my brain. Brain bleeding that occurs on the inside of the brain has a survival rate of about 30%. I survived those odds, but not without consequence. I was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury, a brain injury that I live with every day. I had no idea how much I took for granted until my brain was damaged. I've had to fight back to get back to the simplest of things, like holding a fork or brushing my hair and walking across the room without falling over. Even talking to you today right now is something that I've had to get back, simply talking. February 16th was 3 years since my car crash, and I'm still in therapy. Even today, before I came on this call to talk to the committee, I have had vestibular nerve feedback and counseling therapy. It is a weekly routine for me. All of that fight and loss was because someone couldn't be bothered to secure their load. There is someone else that I would briefly like to talk about today, an article I found that talks about another Alaskan affected by an unsecured load. Sergeant Harris was a Fort Richardson military police who was traveling down on Tudor Road when a projectile came crashing through the windshield at the equivalent of 100 miles per hour and hit Sergeant Harris in the head. The projectile was a steel bar about a foot long, 4 inches wide, about an inch thick, and weighed about 5 pounds that had apparently been ejected off of a pickup truck and slid and shot into the oncoming lane that and then struck the windshield. Sergeant Harris died of his injuries the following day. He was 24 years old.
the time that that driver did not spend to secure their load, Judge Harris paid for with his life. A fellow Alaskan like myself and someone who is my age, and the time that my driver did not spend to properly secure the load, I have paid for with the rest of my life. Payment for something that is entirely preventable. A person chooses not to secure their load just as a person chooses to get behind the wheel of a car drunk. Unsecured loads are a huge problem. Anchorage Solid Waste Services issued 1,392 fines in 2016 for unsecured loads. 1,392 negligent drivers that were on Alaska roads that year, and 1,392 chances for someone to die or be seriously hurt. And that's just accounting for drivers going to the landfill. I hope that this bill will educate and remind everyone how dangerous an unsecured load, and that it will protect everybody in this state and hold these negligent drivers accountable for a choice that has hurt and killed so many people. I ask that you help me change this law, change a law that could not protect me and cannot protect anyone unless there is change. And I thank you again for listening to my story today.
Thank you very much for taking the time to share your experience and story with us. Does anyone have questions for Ms. Roy? I don't see any questions. Thank you very much. Oh, actually, I take it back. Representative Christ-Tompkins does have a question. Go ahead, Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Roy, I was curious about the 1,332, I think it was citations you mentioned from Anchorage Solid Waste Services. And do you have a sense of what constitutes a citation or violation by Anchorage Solid Waste Services, how that relates to the definition of failing to secure a load in the first or second degree as written in this bill?
Through the chair, my general sense from my conversations with Anchorage Solid Waste Services is that if a driver comes up and the load that they have is unsecured, a fine is issued and a ticket is issued for that. And the load being secured when it shows up on to the landfill, the load was unsecured on the roadways. Not sure if I answered your question.
No, thank you. That gives at least a sense.
Question.
Well, it's not really a question. I just wanted to really thank you for bringing this issue forward, because this is obviously a problem which needs to be addressed. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I'll ask if there's anyone in the room that wishes to testify. I don't think so, but I'm just checking. Next, wishing to testify, Aves Thompson from the Alaska Trucking Association. Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
State your name, please.
I wonder if I might add, ask a question.
Mr. Thompson, please, even though I did, you have to do it as well.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm Aves Thompson, Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association, here today to testify on House Bill 259.
Go ahead.
Let me proceed with my testimony before I can ask the question. The trucking industry is heavily regulated by both the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities through their commercial vehicle enforcement. Both sets of regulations contain specific requirements concerning securement of loads. If I might briefly read part of the federal regulation covering this issue that has also been adopted into the Alaska Administrative Code.
Go ahead.
49 CFR Part 393.100, the question is asked, which types of commercial vehicles are subject to the cargo securement standards of this subpart and what general requirements apply? A, applicability. The rules in this subpart are applicable to trucks, truck tractors, semi-trailers, full trailers, and pole trailers. B, prevention against loss of load. Each commercial motor vehicle must, when transporting cargo on public roads, be loaded and equipped and the cargo secured in accordance with this subpart to prevent the cargo from leaking, spilling, blowing, or falling from the motor vehicle. C, prevention against the shifting of load. Cargo must be contained, immobilized, or secured in accordance with this subpart to prevent shifting upon or within the vehicle to such an extent that the vehicle's stability or maneuverability is adversely affected. Given these broad regulations, there are also very specific regulations about confining and securing each individual type of load. It seems to us, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that this legislation is unnecessary and duplicates requirements already in law for commercial motor vehicles. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thompson.
And I may have missed it when you were reading. What sort of penalties are there? I mean, I understand that the trucking industry may be regulated by the feds, but what sort of criminal penalties for violating those regulations?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I would defer that question to the commercial vehicle enforcement officers. I'm not a lawyer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Any other questions for Mr. Thompson? Mr. Thompson, I don't see any others. The next person in the queue is Edward Martin. Mr. Martin, if you can you hear us? Make sure you're not on a speakerphone and ideally not on a cell phone, and you can proceed with your testimony, being sure to identify yourself and any affiliation you may have.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Ed Martin, and I'm from Cooper Landing. I'm representing myself and the firm of Key Construction, LLC. We have numerous trucks, and over the years, and I'm 63 years old, I was driving trucks long before there were CDL rules and long before there was a lot of laws. But just as Abe was saying, that this is an unnecessary new rules under the trucking rules and the commercial code. And in the early days of when I got my first CDL license, I'll give you a little story. I went to, up to Glen Allen to pick up a D9 dozer and put it on a low void and bring it to Anchorage. When I got up to Glen Allen, it was about 10 below. They had the tracks as clean as possible, and I hauled it into Anchorage. And when I got into Anchorage, it was melting. And so a rock fell off of that tractor's tracks onto the deck, and I was immediately fined for unsecure load of a rock on the deck, of which I didn't have any idea. But some things can get a little crazy. It was a $100 fine at the time. I paid the fine. Now, I understand Maria's law, and I have sympathy, believe me, for those that have been injured from unsecure loads. But I don't believe you need to change this law to this freeboard thing because it seems to be irrelevant. And I don't encourage you to add it with a tarp on commercial trucks that haul gravel because the cost to public in the construction of projects, the lost labor time, trying to secure a tarp that may possibly flap, and maybe in an area where you cannot see your load as you're traveling the road. People need to be a little bit just common sense here. I believe that Abe's is correct. I think if you're going to write something into a new law, I think you need to do more defining, and you need to maybe apply it with an exemption under the current federal highway safety standards because they're already covered.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't see any questions.
I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. There are no questions. Just looking through, there's some people online to answer questions. Bob Anderson from the Central Region, Chief for Maintenance and Operations. Captain Dan Loudon of the Alaska State Troopers, and we've already heard from Hillary Martin, as well as Dan Smith, Director of Measurement and Commercial Vehicle Standards, available from Anchorage. But I see no one else in the queue to provide testimony. I see we've added one more person in the room. Anyone here in the room that wants to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 259. I would welcome some conversation. Well, any questions for any of the people available online? I would open it up here for, oh, go ahead. Go ahead. Representative Ledoux.
I was wondering if there was anybody online who could answer the question that I originally asked to Mr. Thompson about whether or not there are any criminal penalties for violating the federal.
That could be Mr. Smith, Mr. Anderson, or Captain Loudon. Do any of you have knowledge that you can answer about secure load, specifically criminal penalties?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Dan Smith. I'm the Director of Measurement Standards and Commercial Vehicles Enforcement. Our officers would write the violation of the 49 CFR that would carry a fine of either $150 or $300.
And follow-up, Representative Ledoux?
And so that's it. Even if you've killed somebody, it's $150 to $300 under the federal laws?
Mr. Smith?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I would defer to Captain Loudon to answer that question. Our officers assist the Alaska State Troopers, and the Alaska State Troopers would be the lead agency in a fatality case.
Captain Loudon, can you answer Representative Ledoux's questions about criminal sanctions? Somebody's failed to meet the federal regulations that would subject them to a penalty. Doesn't sound like the federal regulations provide for a criminal penalty. Is there, are there crimes in Alaska that they could be charged with?
Thank you. This is Captain Dan Loudon with the Troopers, for the record. Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I'm not familiar with the federal code and what those rules are. If a trooper currently is at a fatal crash where someone is hurt or injured, we would look at all the statutes that would be available for us, criminally negligent, homicide, manslaughter, assault, all of those, and the fact situation would probably dictate where we went in charging anyone in those areas.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And through the chair, to Ms. Martin. Ms. Martin, are you aware of any limitations that exist with regard to the statutes that we're talking about that would prohibit someone from seeking relief in civil court?
Yeah, this is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, no, there's nothing that would prohibit civil action under this bill that I'm aware of.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
And a follow-on question?
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. And this time for the sponsor. Now, we're talking about final load here, and I see the words any material. Are there any parameters about the load being talked about here? I know when we talk about loads, generally I think the context is maybe a commercial vehicle or gravel or dirt or something like that. Is there any kind of weight limitation? Does something that's going to be not confined in this statute have to, you know, weigh a certain amount?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's no weight threshold in the bill, to answer your question directly.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And through the chair. And is there any limitation on what kind of materials could be caught up in this definition of a load?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm not a legal attorney, but by my layman's definition of any material, I would say no.
Thank you. And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
So I'm remembering instances where I've seen someone who gets into their car and forgets to secure their trash, so a McDonald's cheeseburger wrapper, you know, flies off. Would that get caught up in this definition of load under this bill, or is there anything here that would put that into some kind of separate category?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it would be caught up, but I would like to caveat that with saying that if a McDonald's bag came out and hit my windshield and I couldn't see and caused me to crash, that would be covered up in the first section, which is failure to secure a load in the first degree. So I think when you're looking at Whether it's a danger to motorists or not, it could be. But if it just flew out of my vehicle and a police officer see it, I would imagine they would cite me for a citation. And in the first instance of that, that would be a $300 fine, which currently there's a littering fine in current statute as well.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
And so I understand there's a current littering statute. So how does that compare if you're being cited under this Part B? Is that more strict than the littering statute, or which is going to have the greater penalty?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, for a 100% positive answer, I would have to defer to Hillary Martin, but I believe that the littering statute it's either $150 or it's $300, as is the infraction in the first one, but there is no sliding scale, as is in the bill right now. So the second one would certainly be, your second violation under the bill would be more harsh than the current statute for littering. And I apologize, but I do not recall whether the littering statute it's either $150, I think, might be a little less than that, but I would defer to Hillary Martin for that one for a specific answer. I can't answer that specifically, sir.
I think Representative Kopp, he has the next question, but he may be able to answer something about the littering.
Sure. Story. Well, Mr. Captain Loudon, of course, is online from the troopers, but I think the littering fine for in the state law is up to $500 fine for littering along state roads, that's even on a first offense. But back to what Representative Eastman was saying, the bill doesn't say any materials. If you look at line 8, page 2, it says similar materials, and similar immediately follow sand, gravel, dirt, rock. It's those types of materials that the bill is addressing. And also, Mr. Chairman, there are axle weight limits on every class of commercial vehicles already in the law that they have to follow. And if you're in a passenger vehicle, if you have overloaded, it's considered improper load in 13AC or AS28. In other words, if the car is bottomed out on its shocks, a trooper or law enforcement officer can fine the driver for an improperly loaded vehicle. So our law does cover those situations where someone might take advantage of weight, either on the commercial end or the passenger vehicle end.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and maybe I'm looking at a different version of the law, but to respond to Representative Kopp. I am looking at version L, and so I was just wondering on page 1, line 11, what types of material is in your version?
And that is further defined on page 2, line 7 through 11. So, like anything, you have to take it all in context. There's where the material is described further.
Thank you.
All right. So, that looks like all the questions. And before we get to, well, so there have been two potential amendments that have been suggested. One would be an amendment to change the property damage amount from $1,000 to $2,000, as appears on page 1, line 8. And I'm asking these questions because I'm trying to figure out if we need to hold the bill to take up amendments or not, and if there are the two amendments, and we can talk about the merits of those. Is there anyone that's interested in bringing up the amendment that would raise the property damage amount from $1,000 to $2,000 so that it tracks the vehicular damage statute that Representative Kopp mentioned earlier? Representative Christon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested, or at least interested in sort of better understanding the parallelism that might create in association with Class A misdemeanors, and at the very least doing that diligence.
And just since we're discussing that amendment,
Representative Kopp,
a further reason for it is, I mean, a ding on the hood of a truck, a new truck, is way over $1,000 just to repair. I mean, a small ding. Yes, I mean, you're right, Representative Millett. It's, you can be at $1,000 without trying, and especially on the newer cars. So I think if we're going to look at misdemeanor territory, which I'm nervous about for the record, we definitely want to raise that property value, and the $2,000 just comes because that's the mandatory report. Otherwise, you're in criminal jeopardy at that point. Yeah.
Well, I will just go ahead, Representative Christ.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think about my own experiences, not unsecured loads or anything, but just having gravel kicked up from other cars and that. I mean, I've driven some pretty old vehicles with some pretty old windshields, and maybe they crack easier, but like right there. So I'm just kind of playing through that scenario. So yeah, I just concur with Representative.
So I would just say, for purposes of moving forward, I think there is interest in amending that from 1,000 to 2,000. So we're not going to move the bill today. That was kind of the preliminary level. Representative Eastman, as to the 1,000 to 2,000, are you on a different topic?
I'll wait for the next topic.
Okay. Any further comment as to that, moving 1,000 to 2,000?
Right. Couldn't we just make that a friendly amendment, and we could just...
Let's go off record for just a minute.
Okay.
While we were off record, we're back on record, and we were discussing whether we might take up the $2,000 increase as a friendly amendment with broad support from the committee, and it sounds like there is, but before we get there, Captain Loudon, there were some questions about other ways in which how this would align to similar offenses regarding damage to automobiles. And if you could, I'm going to let Representative Christ Tompkins ask the question. Are you available again, Captain Loudon?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead, and Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I was interested in sort of related Class A misdemeanors associated with property damage, what the sort of value threshold is associated with those Class A misdemeanors in current law.
This is Captain Loudon for the record. Through the chair, Representative Thompson, those recently changed, and I'd have to look it up to be certain, but I think $5,000 is what's sticking in my head.
And Representative Christ Tompkins, I will note that the set of the statutes that relate to property damage broadly are broadly the criminal mischief statutes. Yeah, you're not Representative Kopp, you want to clarify what areas you were talking about?
Sure. Captain Loudon, we're looking at property damage for vehicles that trigger the mandatory report. Is that at 2,000, or was that also raised recently?
Now that we've focused the question.
Thank you, sir. And I'm trying to flip through the statutes, and I'm sorry, right now I don't have it off the top of my head. But I can certainly look it up if I don't find it here in a second or two.
Have it in a second here.
Okay, while you're looking that up, Representative Eastman, you had another area of inquiry. I'll let you
thank
do
you.
That while Representative Kopp does his research.
Yeah, just to build on our earlier conversation, so we find when we're talking about freeboarding, you know, there's some talk about what types of materials we're talking about. But in B generally, there is no description of any types of material. And so my concern, which may turn into an amendment, is going to be to in some way prescribe or limit the types of materials that we're talking about. And we're talking about a load, and I think most Alaskans wouldn't think of a cheeseburger wrapper as being a load, and yet that
would or would not think of that as
would not think of that as a load. And so if maybe we need to define load somewhere, or what, you know, any material just seems very, very, very broad. And while some may say that, well, that's not, a class, A misdemeanor, because of the most recent change where we, have now dealt with criminal negligence, we have a situation, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, where someone could be in that cheeseburger wrapper scenario, be convicted of that, and then suddenly they now have a conviction, and then now... whatever they do in the future now in category because of littering? And is that really the intent of what we're trying to accomplish?
So that's kind of a question for a little bit of a question for the bill sponsor and a little bit of a generic discussion about issues. Did Mr. Greening, did you want to have a comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe it would be difficult, and this is just my initial blush reaction, but I believe it would be difficult to prove that somebody acted with criminal negligence when a wrapper came out of the back of their truck. That's my first initial reaction there. As far as to whether that could use further definition regarding any material, I would leave that up to the will of the committee through discussions with the chair and drafters.
Okay.
Follow up.
Actually, I want to go back to the $2,000 question. Representative Price Tompkins or Representative Kopp, what did you all conclude about the duty to report vehicle damage to vehicles and the mandatory reporting requirement?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is $2,000. That does trigger the mandatory report.
And Representative Christ Tompkins, did you, in terms of your time and purpose or information for pondering this, is that enough information for you in terms of whether we want to make a friendly amendment for the $2,000 amount?
I think it is. Although, could we have a brief at ease?
We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on record. While we were off record, we had some discussion about the topic about whether we should take up a friendly amendment to increase the property damage amount that appears on line 8 of page 1 from $1,000 to $2,000. Either Representative Kopp or Representative Christ Tompkins, do you have a motion?
To move that? I'll move that. Motion.
Okay, so that's a friendly amendment to increase the property damage amount online to change that number from $1,000 to $2,000. Is there an objection?
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, anybody want to discuss it?
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Earlier it was talked about, an amendment possibly coming to change from, a Class A misdemeanor to something lower than that, and I think that might be important, especially if you were talking about damages of only $2,000, which has been pointed out is fairly easy to do when you're dealing with vehicles and highways, and now you're possibly, at risk of a $25,000 fine as a Class A misdemeanor for a fender bender. And I'm not real comfortable with that. I think that threshold would have to be higher than $2,000 and/or we remove that Class A misdemeanor label.
All right, so I would just note the question of the Class A misdemeanor is a separate question. Right now, the only issue before us is whether to increase the property damage amount for the purposes of this bill from $1,000 to $2,000. Representative Kopp.
I've already made that motion,
I'll
call for the question.
Holistically.
Okay, I don't see any other comment. Is the objection maintained?
I'll remove the objection.
So without objection, the conceptual amendment increasing the property damage amount from $1,000 to $2,000 is approved unanimously. That gets us, I think, to the more complicated question about Class A misdemeanors versus Class B misdemeanors in terms of what the offense represents. And I would just note, because I was involved with the draft or the sponsor's office in terms of working on the bill, I think there's two things to bear in mind. That one of these is that we hear the truckers are unhappy, at least two folks involved with the trucking industry are unhappy, although they're already covered with regulations that dictate and put requirements to them to secure their loads. And we also have heard about, I believe, 1,392 failure to secure load issues at the Anchorage landfill, which suggests that a lot of this may actually be more directed at consumers who don't know what they're doing than truckers who are probably more often effectively securing their loads. But I do recognize that from the testimony and public testimony that the risk of not securing a load is and the potential damage is enormous. Representative Kopp and then Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think kind of the key thing to focus on here is that to get the misdemeanor, you have to have committed this violation with criminal negligence. Criminal negligence in line six is the mental state that has to apply in criminal negligence, according to AS 1181-900 definitions, is a much higher standard than an average not paying attention. It defines an offense when a person fails to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. So a normal negligence would not bump you into misdemeanor territory. It has to be criminal negligence, which, again, is a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would perceive in that situation. So you have to have criminal negligence and cause serious physical injury, which anywhere else in the law would be felony assault. Then, or not causing serious physical injury, you've had to act with criminal negligence or cause property damage in amount. Now, if you don't have criminal negligence and you cause $10,000 in property damage, but the ensuing investigation says, you know, that's a really bummer that happened, but I can see an honest effort was made to secure the load, and, you know, you hit a pothole and a rock flew out and you wiped out the guy behind you. But criminal negligence is a standard you still have to meet. So I don't necessarily think that, I mean, I think it's very good we have a mental state there that has to be met. You know, if we wanted to be even safer, we could ratchet it up to recklessly, which is even a higher standard, which normally is associated with Class A misdemeanors. Criminal negligence probably would be a good one for a Class B misdemeanor. That would be another thing we could think about. But I do think because we have a mental state, that helps justify attaching at some point criminal behavior if that mental state is met. Otherwise, all these things could happen, and for a person who's honestly trying to do the right thing, they're not going to get hit with a misdemeanor ever. They have to have criminal negligence.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I would love to agree with the previous speaker, but on page 2, line 20, we've redefined criminal negligence for purposes of this law. And what we've done is we've said that any violation of this section.
Actually, Representative Eastman, we are not redefining criminal negligence. It's specifically defined in AS 1181-900, which is the existing definition. So we are not redefining criminal negligence. But
Well, we can use some different words to talk about what we're doing on page 2, line 20 then. But what we're doing is we're specifically calling out criminal negligence, and we're specifically calling out any violation of this section as constituting a prima facie violation under criminal negligence. And my concern is that we'll have something which normally wouldn't be considered criminal negligence, i.e. Trash or litter. And now any conviction of trash or litter now bumps you up in Section A to a Class A misdemeanor, because you don't have to have the normal criminal negligence definition criteria. Now you just have to have some previous conviction, which could have been under this section, you know, a simple $300 fine.
Representative Ledoux, and then Representative Christ-Tompkins.
So does criminal negligence ever come into play when there hasn't been either an injury or property damage? And I'm thinking about Representative Easton's scenario about the trash. I mean, could the trash ever injure anybody? I'm just getting very confused by this whole discussion.
So Representative Ledoux, I think there's a certain reality that all of us hear about a McDonald's wrapper and generally think that even if it hits us while we're walking, it's not likely to cause serious physical injury. And so I think sometimes the McDonald's wrapper is hard to conceptualize it, how it gets to this level. I would note that Representative Eastman's descriptions are inaccurate with what this bill does, because a littering violation would not be a prior conviction in this. The only prior convictions would be under this particular statute, which would require a violation of this failure to secure a load and not a littering violation that would count as prior events. But go ahead, Representative Levine.
Yes.
Are there any other criminal negligence crimes that if you've done it before, it's considered prima facie evidence of criminal negligence? Or would this be the only one?
That's more a question we can ask Hillary Martin. That I do know from discussion. Well, Ms. Martin, go ahead and answer that question in terms of are there other crimes in which something can constitute prima facie evidence?
This is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. There are, through the chair, there are some other crimes where certain evidence, that certain facts are prima facie evidence. I don't know offhand if a prior conviction is prima facie evidence similar to this bill. I just don't know of any offhand.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Levine.
Well, it's not exactly a follow-up, but I'm just trying to follow
something. You can still ask the question.
Okay. Follow something here, because I'm looking at 24 through 31, and the second degree, which is an infraction. Is this for when nobody gets hurt?
Yes.
So it's only a Class A misdemeanor when somebody is hurt or there's serious property damage. Is that correct?
Yes.
Somebody?
The way it's written now, yes. But, Mr. Chairman, there's a real misunderstanding of what prima facie is here, and maybe Hillary Martin can support me or say, no, you're wrong. But prima facie just means at first glance, at the first encounter, but it has to support subsequent cooperative investigation. It means when you first look at it, it looks like there's criminal negligence because you had a prior conviction. But you have to actually look to see if that mental state still applies. It's assumed that it does, but you have a defense to say, yeah, I might have, as Mr. Eastman, Representative Eastman has said, the McDonald's wrapper incident or whatever. I think if you can argue that, you know, that was, yeah, it flew out of the bed of my truck, and I had everything bagged up, I do not think that criminal negligence should apply, Your Honor. I realize that at the first glance it applies because I have a prior violation, but I think you still have a legal defense. It's just now more on you to show that that shouldn't alone push you into the criminal negligence state, but I would love to have a lawyer comment on that.
So it changes the burden of proof, though. I mean, under a normal criminal trial, you get charged, and you can keep your you don't have to say anything. You don't have to present a defense. But this makes it so that you don't have to prove anything, actually, for criminal negligence other than that somebody has done something before. I think I'm correct on that, although at this point I'm so confused.
Representative, Representative Lou, for saying that you're confused, it's Evidence Rule 303B, and Ms. Martin will confirm that if I've got the section right, but I think it's 303B. Or maybe it's 303E, but there's an evidence rule that specifically talks about it's a burden, it shifts the burden. So if you establish the prima facie case, then that would shift to the defendant to disprove the criminal negligence, which is consistent with what Representative Kopp said. And Ms. Martin, did I get the section right or did I get that wrong?
This is Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services. It is rules 303 talks about presumptions, and 303B, prima facie evidence.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
I'm looking now at 21 through 31 on page 2. And maybe what I'm missing is AS 1255. So it's first degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor, but only if somebody is hurt or... And where does it say that?
That's on page 1, subsection A, lines 7, really lines 6 through line 9.
Well, where does that refer to AS 1255?
Well, it doesn't. The AS 1255 is just providing the penalty provisions on line 20, 22 and 23. That just says if you violated the first degree, and if you read line 5, it says a person commits the crime of failure to confine, container confine a load in the first degree if the person with criminal negligence violates B and then causes the injury or the property damage. And so that just gives you the classification of the first degree offense.
So is second degree, do you have to have criminal negligence too?
No. That's a strict liability offense.
And where does it say that?
It says that if you read lines 10 through line 12, a person commits the offense if the person drives or moves a motor vehicle with any material. On page 1.
A person commits offense of failure to contain, confine, or load in a second degree.
I wonder if I... In the second degree, okay.
I'm going to let Representative Eastman ask his question. Actually, Representative,
I was in the queue.
Oh, I didn't have you in the queue. I'll put you. J.K. Mr. Representative Christ Tompkins was next in the queue. Then Representative Millett, and then Representative Eastman. Go ahead, Mr. Representative.
I guess this is going to be more a comment or a question for the sponsor. I think given both the mens rea that Representative Kopp has noted, the either adjusting criminal negligence to recklessness, which I take his word is more consistent with other Class A misdemeanors, or I think there was another parallel noted earlier in committee testimony. I would float the or be interested in the sponsor's reaction of whether a Class B misdemeanor would feel amenable. I have to say, at least sort of given committee discussion right now, that sort of just sort of calibrating a little bit better with me, at least. So I just wanted to put that out there for the sponsor's consideration. And actually, I'm just going to throw one other thought. I mean, I think the piece that really catches me is the property damage and $2,000 of vehicular property damage. And I mean, I think there's probably $10,000 of property damage on my Jeep right now. I've just never taken it into a shop to deal with it. And I mean, that's 5 Class A misdemeanors right there. So I think that part I feel really uncomfortable making a Class A misdemeanor. The cause of serious physical injury or to another person, that piece feels more appropriate, and potentially separating those out feels like that might do it.
Representative Millett.
So,
I apologize for missing you.
That's okay. I'm not here often. So I agree with Representative Eastman. We go as you read the classifications for Class A misdemeanor, Class B misdemeanor, correlating that with criminal negligence and recklessness. I think we just need some time to show equity in Class A and Class B misdemeanors through. I mean, because I understand what you're trying to do, but I think we're going overboard with Class A misdemeanor when it comes to what you're trying to do, but. I mean, because it has progression in it, but I just think a comparative would probably be good.
And Representative Eastman is next in the queue. I would just note that it may be, although this as drafted has both together in a first degree offense, it may be that the comfort level with a Class A misdemeanor, even with criminal negligence for serious physical injury, this committee would be very comfortable with a Class A misdemeanor when serious physical injury is involved, but feel differently about property damage.
Right.
And so it might well be that the direction that we want to go, and clearly we're not going to resolve this today, but it may be the direction we want to go is make a Class B misdemeanor when there's property damage and a Class A misdemeanor when serious physical injury is involved. Those are just queries. Representative Eastman, you're next up.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'll just also restate that I think, yeah, the Class A misdemeanors is probably a little bit more than we need in this kind of situation. But let's go back for a moment. And we heard testimony a few minutes ago from someone who had a load that was secured, involved snow and ice, which often is the case here in Alaska. And then you have a situation where some of that snow or ice melts, and you have a rock or a pebble or something that's now an unsecured load. I mean, these things happen. And maybe if you're talking about someone who does this for a living and is doing it in a commercial setting, then that can be prevented through training and those sorts of things. But I think we need to go back to the definition of a load and make sure that that is the context which we're talking about, because I don't think any number of prosecutions under this kinds of situation is going to train your average member of the public who deals with snow and ice and pebbles and who knows what else on their cars. I don't think that they're ever going to get the message based on stiffer penalties, in a misdemeanor, even a misdemeanor B category. So I'm uncomfortable of sort of criminalizing things which we wouldn't necessarily think of as criminal, because usually there isn't criminal intent. And, you know, whether it's trash and littering, which, as was pointed out, is covered under separate, there's a separate penalty for that, regardless of this. But I see pebbles and, I've been in cars in the last month where you have pebbles hitting windshields and causing all sorts of damage, and that's a pretty frequent occurrence for a lot of Alaskans. And so I want to shift the conversation outside of the criminal side of things and make sure that those kinds of situations, that kind of behavior, is treated more normally under civil sanctions. And if you cause damage, then someone can take you to court and can recover those damages under the normal process. But I don't know that a criminal conviction is going to help someone be made well because a rock hit their windshield, which no matter how much training or how narrowly we tailor these types of provisions, that stuff's still going to happen. And in some cases, maybe it is, criminally negligent, but I think in a lot of cases, it probably isn't.
So, Representative Ledoux's next in the queue. We're at 11, about 12 minutes after. I want to wind up at about 3:15, but I would broadly say this is the subject of lots of discussion. I'm clearly not ready to move the bill. I know we've got a pretty busy schedule next week. We're not meeting next Friday. And so my thinking on this is that we probably won't hear it until the week after next, and I'm thinking of putting a deadline in for amendments of next Friday at 5. Representative Ledoux, you're next in the queue.
I can't remember my question anymore.
All right. Representative Kopp.
Yeah, just to kind of clarify the previous discussion for the previous speaker, criminal offense would never apply unless you had already demonstrated criminal negligence. So you have to meet that criminal negligence standard, otherwise you're not ever facing a criminal. So if you've acted with criminal negligence and you cause serious physical injury as a result of failing to secure your load, something comes out, you should be in criminal territory, and rightly are. I think any of us on this committee disagree with that. Criminal negligence is, again, it is a gross standard of deviation from a care that a reasonable person would exercise in that same circumstance. So then if our issue is property damage, again, the criminal negligence applies. If you're not acting with criminal negligence, it doesn't matter if you wipe out someone's entire $45,000 pickup. as long as if what happened was an accident and the accident investigation shows you were not, and by the way, if you were criminally negligent, there's a lot of other things you're going to be charged with other than this, starting with vehicular assault, vehicular homicide, with reckless endangerment. There's many things in the law that you're going to be in serious criminal jeopardy beyond what this is. I think the idea of I appreciate what you said about not over criminalizing things. I'm glad there's differentiation in your mind on that depending on the issue. But I think that, you know, again, having a mental state here, we're protected on getting too far astray on that.
And I will use the privilege of the chair to just make a couple of comments, and then we'll wind up for the day. The question of civil liability versus criminal liability, one of the ways we reflect our society's values is when we believe certain conduct is so egregious that we want to criminalize it. That not only reflects our values, but it also reflects an expectation on the part of the public that's very different than civil liability. And when I listened to the testimony you heard from Kelly Roy about what she experienced when somebody didn't secure her load, and when I listened to the testimony from Robin Abel about what happened to her daughter when somebody didn't secure her load, I don't think this belongs just in civil territory. I think it is appropriate, particularly when serious physical injury occurs, that there be a criminal sanction, because that's one of the ways in which our folks in Anchorage can say to people at the landfill, you don't secure your load, you're looking at potential criminal sanctions, and people get hurt, and you need to fix that. And there are 1,392 unsecured loads at the Anchorage landfill says something needs to change, and it's not going to change just with civil liability. And so I believe it is appropriate. I think the question about serious physical injury versus property damage is a very appropriate thing for us to be trying to figure out the parameters, but I don't think civil liability is enough to express society's views in terms of the importance of securing loads. So with that editorial comment, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Monday, February 26th at 1 p.m. If you are thinking of amendment to House Bill 259, the deadline for those amendments will be 5 p.m. next Friday. I would encourage you to talk with other committee members and see where there can be consensus so that we don't have too many amendments. If anyone is considering an amendment to House Bill 316, Marijuana Possession Expungement, sponsored by Representative Drummond, please let my office know. I think we had previously announced that those would be due at 5 p.m. today, but it is my intention to take up any amendment to that bill on Monday. And I will remind my committee members once again that we will not be meeting next Friday, March 2nd. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 3:17 p.m.